ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
Around 78 million years ago, a massive asteroid struck Earth. No, not that one. This one, the impact formed a 23-kilometre-wide crater in Lake Lapajärvi in Finland. Temperatures soared to roughly 2,000 degrees centigrade, the enormous heat basically sterilising the surrounding rock completely. And, of course, it killed pretty much every microbe. It's a massive region of now thriving Earth with life aplenty in the waters and surrounding regions, and scientists wanted to know just how it recovered from such a catastrophic impact. Dr. Sarah Webb is an author and science communicator and astrophysicist from Swinburne and is here to tell us about this fascinating new study. Sarah, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you for having me back. Oh, welcome. This is truly fascinating. I love anything that involves the giant impact crater microbes.
When I mentioned it, of course, the massive asteroid struck Earth, everyone thinks I'm talking about the one that hit the Gulf in Caribbean.
Yes.
But we're not talking about that one that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. This one's pretty big, though, 23-kilometre-wide crater in Finland. What? Tell me about it.
It is enormous. So this one was a little bit earlier on than the one that ended up killing the dinosaurs. So this was about 78 million years ago. Mm-hmm. So there would have been life teeming in the Jurassic period during that time. What is amazing about this, though, is that we know that the Earth has been bombarded by aplenty of asteroids in the Earth's lifetime. It's not actually a rare occurrence. Mm-hmm. But what is quite rare about this particular this basin that it created when it impacted the Earth was not only do we still see it today, it's still actively a lake. We're able to go and explore it. We're able to actually go and get data from within it. And what is amazing about this particular study is they were using different samples that was collected from beneath the basin, deep core samples, and then also sediment samples, to try and understand exactly how extreme would this environment have been and piece together what happened that 78 million years ago.
It does sound a unique experiment. Tell me, the rock was apparently heated to around 2,000 degrees centigrade. Well, that would have been the end of everything, wouldn't it?
It sure would have. It would have been hot enough to essentially sterilize the entire environment. So large creatures would not have survived, and the very small, the microbes, the things that drive our ecosystems would have completely been wiped out. And what the scientists wanted to understand is, how long does it take for something like this to recover? You know, is it a one big impact and then 100 years later you've got microbes again? And it turns out that's certainly not the case. So for some other impact craters, they tend to say that it can take, you know, up to a few thousand years sometimes for places to recover and for microbial life to be healthy. For this particular site, though, the impact was so grand, it was so hot, the water was so heated because of it, it took about 4 million years until we saw a healthy microbial life.
It took 4 million years for life to reestablish.
Isn't that an incredible amount of time? By the time life had reestablished, the dinosaurs were almost on their way out. They only had a little bit of time left there. And I think it's interesting not only for understanding how the Earth has had to adapt and change to these impact events, but also thinking about how other worlds, moons, alien worlds out there might also adapt and change with massive events like this.
Yeah, because the whole area took a long time to cool down, didn't it?
It did. A very, very long time to cool down, longer than you would expect. And the scientists theorize that it's probably because of the type of bedrock that was in this particular area. There was lots of granite, lots of different material that reacts a little bit differently to internal cooling and heating. But it really depends on almost the draw of the luck where you are when an event like this happens.
Yeah, all right. Now, tell me about this 12-year-old boy who lives in Canada, who's been called the youngest Canadian ever to find an asteroid. What? He's only 12.
He's only 12.
He's got a powerful telescope. What's he?
Oh, I think he'll have a powerful telescope one day. He has been working with data from other telescopes around the world. So, part of a citizen science project. Now, this young man's name is Sathith, and not only has he discovered one asteroid, he's actually discovered two through the citizen science project. And what has been happening is he's helping scientists by looking at images taken from different telescopes around the world and trying to classify asteroids that are previously unknown to us moving through our solar system. And it's a lovely interview with him and his parents, with just this passion that he has for astronomy. And I have no doubt that he will go far in his life and
So
career.
is he a mathematics whiz, is he? Or he's obviously a data analyst whiz.
I think he's just a science, a whiz, and enthusiast. So the citizen science projects tend to be very kind to anyone who doesn't have a background in science. And so you're able to get data and you can analyze it locally on your computer or on a website. And this is a reminder that any one of us can do citizen science at any time. And I wanted to remind listeners of the amazing project. Many of them have probably heard about it before, called Zooniverse. And it's a place online where you can go, and scientists are essentially asking for help to classify data, to look for data. And you could do anything. You could help spot wildlife, to spotting asteroids, to even looking for black holes. And it's as simple as going to a website, and we teach you how to do things when scientists put data up on these websites. It's quite intuitive in a way.
How about that? So where should people go if they wanted to, if they're interested?
It's called zooniverse.org.
So that's
And
Zune as in with a Z, is it?
Zune as in with a Z, yes, like zoo.
Okay.
That's right. There's one that
Zooniverse, okay.
Zooniverse, there's one on there at the moment that listeners might be interested in, which is called Cloud Spotting on Mars. And it's using data from orbiters around Mars, trying to see if we can find clouds on Mars, which sounds really counterintuitive because Mars is very different to our planet, where we do have a nice, healthy cloud cover. But it's really important to try to understand what the Martian atmosphere is actually like and changing. And that's a brand new one that people might be interested. I've done it for a few minutes today already, and I'm loving it.
Have you discovered any clouds, Sarah?
Not yet, sadly. It's been all sunny days for me.
Speaking of sunny days, here's a sunny day that's about you too. You led an experiment last year where you sent multiple types of fungi to the International Space Station for a couple of months. Now, you can go there personally, that's okay. So tell me about this experiment, and that, because they're now safely back in Australia. How come?
They are. So we sent three different types of mushrooms to the International Space Station. We wanted to understand, does space change the way fungi wants to grow? Fungi is one of the most amazing organisms that we have on this planet. Not quite an animal, not quite a plant, an entirely unique thing. And mushrooms for our diets are exceptionally important. And there's a couple mushrooms that we think are really good for our gut and our brain health. So that's lion's mane and turkey's tail. Some people might be familiar, or already take supplements of it. And we were thinking about long-term space exploration and the idea that we need to be able to grow food in space. And ultimately, it might make the food better. We might be able to grow produce up there that has more of good elements, good chemicals for our body. So that's what we did. We sent different types of fungi up. They had a lovely trip to the space station and back and spent a few months on orbit. And they've just returned to Australia and have grown nice and healthy.
Hang
So
on, are they
currently,
come back with the astronauts back
they
in?
do,
Okay, right.
they do. They come back sitting right underneath the astronauts, actually, in their right underneath their chairs in a
Oh,
Crew
okay. And they're back
Dragon.
in your lab.
Yet they are. They're currently on my dining bench as I grow up one of our fruiting blocks. So for
Isn't that
science.
incredible? Because so you've got a mushroom that's been to space and back.
Yeah, I do. I do, and it's growing mighty strong.
So what did you discover?
So we're still doing experimental testing in the labs to try to figure out what the changes were. But so far, what we've discovered is that two species of the mushrooms that we sent up really liked space. They survived very well, and they're thriving here on Earth. One species that we sent up, though, Cordyceps, hated it. It didn't return alive and well, unfortunately.
What would it, because I mean, there's radiation up there, isn't there?
Yeah, you get slightly more radiation in the space station. It also could be the stress of launch and return.
Yeah.
So going up on a rocket is it's not very peaceful. So I really don't blame the mushroom for saying that's enough for me. But I'm very excited to see what our chemical analysis shows. But just from growing them on plates and then growing up to the big fruiting bodies, they're so healthy and so lovely. And in fact, I'm going to eat some later this week as a scientific test to see if they also
Hang on,
taste
you're going to
good.
eat a mushroom that was grown in space.
I sure am.
Good idea. Hey, well, but hang on, they're also growing in a zero gravity environment.
Yes.
So,
Yeah.
mind you, they're not very weighty mushrooms, but so how does that seem to affect them? Do they still grow nice and tall and upright?
So the fungi that we sent up, we didn't let it fruit in space. It would
Okay.
have started making the very beginnings of mushrooms, very, very tiny, what we call fruiting bodies of the mycelium network. But it wasn't until they returned to Earth that essentially we let that mycelium, the fungi, run wild, and then it's able to produce that fruit. And we were able to do it with help from our friends from Aussie Mushroom Supplies, who were so excited when I emailed them and said, "Hi, I'm this crazy scientist that would really love help sending mushrooms to space. Can you chat to me about mushrooms?" And they jumped right on board. And so it's thanks to them that we have some fantastic data and hopefully some delicious data as well.
Now, you would have, I mean, I don't want to get too scary about this, Sarah, but you would have been familiar with the series of films Aliens. You would be aware then that eating creatures from outer space is no good.
I am, and I'm willing to sacrifice myself for science just in case.
I see. All right. Isn't that good? Here we are, Aussies doing their bit with science in space. Sarah Webb is going to study, or is studying, and is even going to eat mushrooms that have been in space and have come back. Good to talk with you, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.